You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. My name is Ted Geyer. I'm a senior fellow and co-director here at Economic Studies at Brookings, and I'm going to be presenting a paper that I co-authored with Karen Dinan, who you're going to hear from in a minute. We're going to split it in half, and our third co-author, Natasha Plotkin, formerly of Brookings, is not here, unfortunately, today. So we're going to present our findings on a study of the federal and state home buyer tax incentives. And then we're going to have a panel moderated by our colleague Bill Gale, who will come and talk more broadly on housing policy. And so we're very appreciative for our panel for being here today as well, and for Bill for moderating. We'll start off with me and Karen, and then take some questions if you guys have any, and then go to the panel and take further questions after that. And I should note our gratitude towards the MacArthur Foundation, which was critical for the funding of this project and support of this project, which Karen and I have been working on for quite some time now. Okay, let me see if I can get this going. Okay. So the tax credits, home buyer tax credits. So if you kind of go back to early 2008, you'll recall we were in the midst of a housing market collapse. Existing sales had dropped by nearly 50% from their peak. Home prices had dropped by 16%, and as we were to learn, that was still much more to come. Starts and permits were down by more than 50%, and new foreclosures were essentially doubled, or more than doubled, since compared to during the housing boom. So this led to a flurry of legislative activity on trying to boost the housing market, and particularly a housing market or housing demand, starting with the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, which was passed in the summer of 2008, end of July, or signed actually early August, I believe. This was more famously known for its support of Fannie and Freddie, but it also provided a tax credit to first-time home buyers. Let's see if this works. So I'm in the first columns. Starting April 2008, it was originally supposed to go through the middle of 2009. It was truncated because we, as we'll see in a second, there was a new bill that superseded it. It was a tax credit of 10% of the purchase price up to $7,500, and importantly, it was only for first-time home buyers. Had income cutoffs, income eligibility cutoffs phased out. And I think most importantly about the original house tax credit is, you'll see in this column here, the repayment requirement. So for this tax credit, it was essentially more of an interest-free loan than it was a tax credit. The buyers, you got your tax credit up to $7,500, but you're required to repay it in 15 installments as a surcharge on your income taxes. And if you sold your home before you paid it off, then the proceeds of your home would have to, the gains on your homes would have to go to the repayment of essentially of this loan that you got from the federal government. And we'll see when Karen talks about it, our results essentially, kind of in empirical terms, we treat this more of a control than a treatment. Because it wasn't a credit per se, it was more of a loan, the effects were diminished compared to the refundable credits that came later that weren't had to be paid back. So that brings us to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, as we know, was the big stimulus bill passed in early 2009. Some slight changes from the previous one. The maximum amount of the tax credit was went from $7,500 to $8,000, also refundable. And as I just alluded to, most importantly, it was this was a credit that need not be paid back, so there was no repayment requirement. Therefore, much more of a stimulus or a boost to housing to the incentive to purchase. And then originally this was, as we see, supposed to end in November 30th, 2009. As we were getting close to that date, there was legislative activity to renew it and expand it. And so before we hit November 30th, we got a new bill signed into law in early November, on November 6th, effective November 7th. Which extended the first-time home buyer tax credit, kept it at $8,000 as a maximum, and then in addition added a tax credit for repeat buyers. So there was a $6,500 tax credit for repeat buyers. A repeat buyer, you had to be own your home and have lived in your home for the previous 5 years to be eligible for this. They raised the income limits, the cutoffs for income qualification. And again, this was not there was no repayment requirement. So you'll see, and Karen will talk about the results in a few minutes. There are already important distinctions across the federal programs, and as I'll talk about in a minute, there were state programs also that also had various distinctions. So one would be what were the types of buyers? They had different income thresholds, first time versus repeat buyers, the value of the credit, or we'll see in the state or the loans. If you want to talk about the first one as a loan, and some of the state programs also varied across the states and across the federal programs. An important consideration also is the timing of when you received the credit. So with ERA and the WHBAA, you were allowed to submit amended returns, so you didn't have to wait to tax time in order to get your credit. But you're not getting – even if you submit an amended return, there is return. There's still a bit of time before you actually get the money in your pocket. I think even more so because there was a heightened concern with fraud. I think there was a disproportionate amount of audits for these returns as it was. So even in the best case scenario, you're not going to receive the dollar amount until after you close on your house. So if you're liquidity constrained, that could be a bit of a burden. And as we'll talk about soon, the state programs, some of them tried to address that by providing grants or loans in advance of the closing on the house. Okay, so in July of 2010, the GAO did an assessment using our IRS data on the take-up of these tax programs. So this is incomplete assessment because this goes through July 2010. It doesn't go through all those submitted claims through the end of the WHBA tax credit. But nonetheless, it gives you a sense of the take-up. For the HERA tax credit, which, as I said, was mostly a loan, you had about a million households take up the credit. The amount claim was $7.3 billion. Again, a lot of that was to be repaid back. For ERA, you had 1.7 million credits, totaling about $12 billion in amount claim. And then for the WHBA, we split up here. As we said, there was both the first-time and the repeat tax credits, disproportionately more towards first-time home buyers, close to 400,000, where you had about 185,000 for repeat home buyers. GAO was tried to project ahead of how much ultimately all these credits were cost, and their projection was it was going to be $22 billion. Not surprisingly, if residents in California, Texas, and Florida, three biggest states, claimed 27% of the total number of credits and the value, about the same amount of the value of the credits. On a per household basis, if you looked at states, how much they received in tax credit and divided by total households, not home purchasers, but households, Nevada had $235 per household. They were the highest, which is about 70% more than those received in the median states. Mostly the central and western regions tended to get more per household than the other states. So $22 billion is a decent amount of money, but it's important to put it in context of other housing programs that were going on at this time. This is taken from a CBO analysis in 2009 of 2009 federal support for home ownership. So this is just the home ownership side, not the various government programs for renting, although, as many of you probably know, we disproportionately support home ownership to renting. In that CBO report, the split was $230 billion for home ownership subsidies and $60 billion for renting. And among the government support for home ownership, a disproportionate amount of that is in the form of tax expenditures. Most notably, as you'll see here, the mortgage interest deduction was valued at $800 billion subsidy for 2009. The second one here, Making Home Affordable program, that is essentially the HAMP program to mitigate foreclosures and to spur some mortgage modifications and refinancing. The dollar amount that CBO put here was $50 billion. This is how much was committed. Ultimately, less was spent. But if you go down the list, you can see the first-time homebuyer tax credit kind of in the middle of the list at $14 billion. So it's small compared to the other the overall support that the government was providing for home ownership. It's 11% of the amount of home ownership support that was given in the form of tax expenditures and 6% of the total federal support for home ownership for 2009. So it's relatively small. Okay. As we'll get to in the analysis as well, we started this project somewhat naively thinking we were just going to evaluate federal programs, and then we saw, and we are actually fortunate enough today to have someone from Utah to talk about it, one of these state programs. So the states were not surprisingly highly active in supplementing or complementing the federal programs. Most of these state programs took the form of loans. I think the idea is if people are liquidity constrained and they don't have money for their down payment or for their closing costs, and they have to wait for their tax credit to come later, that doesn't help them if they're liquidity constrained. So why don't we try and give them essentially, for the most part, an interest-free loan, except for a couple states, it was an interest-free loan, so that they can essentially use their credits as collateral for these loans and have some money for down payments and for closing costs. The idea being after you receive your tax credit, so after tax time, there's a kind of a pre-established date where this loan is going to reset into a higher rate if you don't pay it off then by using your credit. So many states had such programs. Four states, California, Georgia, Maine, and Utah in particular, they went further by offering credits and or grants. California, Georgia, and Utah provided these for credits and grants for both repeat and first-time home buyers, whereas Maine was particular to only first-time home buyers. These were, for California and Georgia, non-refundable credits, but you can kind of spread them out over a number of years. I think in the case of California, it was 3 years, and I think it was longer in the case of Georgia. And the grants for Maine and Utah were helpful because they were received in time that you could actually apply them to your closing costs and down payments. And Jonathan will be talking about one of my favorite name programs, which is Utah's Home Run Program. Okay. Okay, so the question is, how might these home buy tax credits actually help the economy? And we kind of talk about in the paper a number of ways that they can conceivably boost housing demands and be helpful, especially in this time of great economic weakness, especially in the housing market. So if you got housing appreciation through boosting demand for housing, you can create housing wealth effects. Increasing the capital gains would induce homeowners to raise their consumption of non-housing goods and services, which would be helpful to the broader economy. Higher home prices also would reduce foreclosures. We're actually seeing this now as people, as the last year or two, as we've seen house price appreciations, fewer and fewer people are underwater. And when you're not underwater, you can sell your house instead of foreclosing. If you are underwater and you can't make your payments, then you don't have that option. And then foreclosure is a likely outcome more times than not. Home price appreciation could also facilitate financing. If you're underwater, it's frequently hard to refinance, or at least to refinance into favorable rates. The government has a HARP program that is meant to address this, but it's only a partial remedy, and it's only a relatively recent remedy at that, which wasn't really in existence as it is, to the extent that it is later on at the time that these tax credits were passed. If you absorb excess inventory through these tax credits, you can encourage new construction, which obviously, as we've seen historically, an increase in residential investment frequently leads us out of recession, so that could be helpful for the broader economy. And then overall, additional cash flow from the credits could and the ancillary effects could stimulate broader demand. I would just note some caveats, and we talk about this in the paper as well. A lot of these positive effects only go insofar as we have incremental purchases. So you can imagine a program where it just spurs everybody to trade homes with their neighbors, and while you get some transaction costs from that, and it does have some of the effects that I listed on the other slide, most notably through kind of realtor fees and all the rest, it doesn't absorb excess inventories and therefore get at the root problem of the housing market and spur additional construction. And then the other issue that is most that we bring up, we analyze in our empirical results as well, which is a key issue when you're designing these things, is the timing of it. All these programs had kind of end dates, and as we've seen, and it's kind of interesting, as we approached the end date, we kind of kept renewing them, but ultimately they did end. And so the question is, how much of any increased housing demand that you see is actually pulling forward from future purchases, and maybe that's a good thing. You want to kind of smooth out the business cycle, but you need to at least account for that payback. And finally, needless to say, you need to consider the alternative uses of these tax dollars. In previous analysis that I did, I found that the cost per additional sale was actually fairly high for these programs, and the reason being that most of the people who took up the credits were people who were going to buy a home anyway. So you need to keep that in, into consideration when comparing it to other forms of stimulus. So with that, I'm going to leave it to Karen to continue from there.
Great. Thanks. Okay. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about, what you see in the data when it comes to these tax credits. And, you know, as Ted was saying, there are lots of ways they could potentially affect economic activity. But it's also really complicated, because, you know, the effects could be smaller or larger depending on exactly how you design those credits. So, as I'll discuss, I mean, it was pretty hard to identify the effects for a variety of reasons having to do with the data. And our approach basically involved looking at the credits in a number of different ways. And I'm going to cover a couple of those ways. What we didn't do is we didn't take the traditional approach that was often seen in kind of news coverage of these credits at the time, which was, you know, traditionally, you know, analysts would take the effective change in the price of the house implied by the credit, and then multiply it by what economists would call the elasticity of demand, which is basically the sensitivity of sales to prices. So the reason we didn't do that, there were two reasons we didn't do that. One was that sensitivity, that elasticity, you know, typically they're based on historical data. You know, this is a very unusual period. So who knows if those elasticities hold in a period where, you know, people, for example, are having a hard time getting a mortgage loan to buy a house, even if they want a house. So that was one of the reasons we didn't do it. But the other reason is something that Ted alluded to, which is just that you can get lots of sales, but if people are simply just trading the houses, particularly if, you know, a credit, say, applies to, you know, repeat home buyers, then, you know, you're not getting that net increase in demand that's going to absorb the excess inventory. So, you know, if you're really thinking about what's going to happen to economic activity, that's what you really want to see. So what did we do? So, you know, to start, what we did was we just kind of plotted out some of the key housing market indicators and eyeballed it to see what was going on. And so this is a chart that does that. We have home sales, home prices, and then two measures of construction, building permits and housing starts in the bottom. And what we've done is we've put in vertical lines for the start of the HERA program, the start of the ERA program, and the start of the WHBAA program, along with a vertical line showing the end of all the credits, as well as what was initially announced to be the end of the credits. That's the dotted line. So here's what you see. I think in all the charts, you can see, you know, something that's pretty dramatic, which is a housing market that's really rapidly deteriorating. You see this kind of going downhill. And really, nothing really happens when the HERA credit was introduced. So this is one of our kind of conclusions of the study, which was that this interest rate free loan, as might be expected, you know, didn't, you know, pay off as much in the long run for homeowners and didn't seem to have much effect on housing demand. But then you can see the decline is kind of arrested with the introduction of ERA. The problem there is that there were a ton of things going on at the time. I mean, think about it. This was a huge piece of stimulus legislation, had lots of features supposed to affect demand in the economy. The Fed was also entering, it was making changes to its quantitative easing program. We had various financial market stabilization measures like the commercial bank stress tests, and we had some housing-specific programs. We had these foreclosure mitigation programs. So those all kind of caution against tying a strong link between the introduction of the ERA credit and this stabilization of the housing market. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But what you can see if you look at, particularly in home sales, which is what you think the credit's going to affect most directly, is you can definitely see effects of the credit. I mean, you can see as ERA was passed, you can see home sales starting to rise. And then right before people thought the whole credit was going to end, what you see is a kind of a pop in sales. They didn't, for the most part, people did not expect this renewal with WHBAA. So you see the pop in sales, and then you see kind of then a pause after that. But you see sales, going up again over the remainder of the period until the program was supposed to end. And then, falling noticeably after the program, the initial deadline for the program did pass. So you do see in these kind of short-term fluctuations, kind of modest effects of the program, and they're not simply effects on sales. You do see, now, you're not going to see the kind of pronounced wiggles because, things like prices and construction are kind of indirectly affected, unlike sales, which are very directly tied to the credit. But you do see what looks like some effects of the credit, for example, with housing prices, where you can kind of see them going up when the credit was available and then coming down just a bit after the credit ended. Okay, so let me talk about what we did to formalize our results with the macro data. And, here, as I said, the big problem, I'm thinking about the fact that the market kind of suddenly stabilized after the credits were introduced. There's a big identification problem in that there were so many other things going on. So we did a very simple exercise with the time series data, which is just that we did a statistical model that related the time series data to its traditional determinants, things like income, wealth, interest rates, confidence. So these are all things that you might see all these other factors like the Fed's actions and the rest of ERA reflected in. They're going to soak up a lot of that. So we ran these models and we did basically a projection of where these indicators should have gone according to the models. And then we looked at the difference between what actually happened and the projections. And that kind of gives you an upper bound on the effects of the program. So I'm just going to show you one example of our results here. This is for house prices. And I'm choosing this example because it's one of the places you can see it most clearly. It's some of the largest effects that we find. But what you see is that, the actual pattern of sales is the blue line, and you can see what the models were projecting. Now, I have different lines on here because we estimated the model over different periods, and that implies a different projection. But what you can see is that prices were indeed higher than the models, a good bit higher than the models were projecting after the credit was introduced. Now, you don't want to put too much weight on this particular example because it's an upper bound on the effects. Because those traditional determinants, we think they're soaking up a lot of the other things that are going on, but there were surely things that were not captured, surely things related to these other things going on that were not captured in the data themselves. And so this entire gap is probably explained by a number of things. And then the other thing is that we found that the different models that we used, depending on the time period that we estimated over and the variables we were looking at, they weren't all that stable. There were some big differences. So again, that kind of signaled to us that we should put a big confidence interval around that. So let me talk quickly about another approach that we took, which was to use these state programs, which, as Ted alluded to, complicated our lives in some senses, but turned out to be kind of a nice place to find additional variations to try to test for the effects of these programs. So what we did was we ran a regression that's shown here in the middle of the page. And basically, we are looking at different housing market outcomes, and we are kind of looking at how they differed over the period during which the program was active, okay, controlling for other things that were going on in these states. So, it's a way to evaluate the effects of these state programs. the limitation of this approach is that the state programs were also different from each other, that we had a hard time kind of putting them on a common basis because it's kind of comparing apples to oranges, but at least it gives you some sense of whether these indicators were stronger over the period during which these state programs were in effect. And these are, I apologize for kind of all the numbers on this page. I will just quickly try to get to the bottom line. But these are some of our results. The four columns are sales, house prices, and then permits and housing construction. Okay. The bottom line of what we find is that for the period during which these state programs were in effect, we did see an increase in housing sales. I think that's your phone. it's not my sound effects. And we did see an increase in housing prices. Not large, 2% increase in sales, 0.5% increase in prices. Not much effect on anything that looked like construction. That's not to be, that's not too big a surprise given that there was so much excess inventory at the time. And then the other thing we found was that, the effect goes away for sales after the programs are over, but we didn't see this payback when it came to the state programs. And with prices, we actually saw them staying at a higher level after the programs were over. So there is some indication that these state programs were working. I should say it's not on this slide, but we did at least, as I said, it's hard to kind of put them all on the same basis, but we did look at grant programs versus loan programs separately, and we found the grant programs did have a more powerful effect on activity, which is what might be expected since they were more generous. So, that's the bottom line with our results. Since I'm out of time, I will just, quickly summarize what we found. Not much indication that the HERA tax credit did much. The ERA tax credit, it did coincide with a dramatic stabilization of housing activity, but we think there was too much else going on to strongly tie the two things together. But kind of looking at all the different things that we looked at, we think that the home buyer tax credits did have some modest effect on economic activity in this period. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Before we get to our panel, we want to just give you guys a chance to ask any questions you might have about the paper. Yeah, question in the second row. And there's a microphone coming around. Please give your name.
Yeah, my name's Li Yang. I just wonder if you have addressed some important factors which affect home buyers or consumers' purchasing powers or their willingness to spend to buy the house. So, for instance, if second homeowners who are more likely to buy the house or maintain their house, and they are willing to help their youngsters or first-time buyer, they did as you define, so they have more purchasing power to help them rather than you just kind of tax credit. When tax credit is maybe in your analysis have some effect, but I think eventually it's really benefit the developers or their team, maybe including lawyers or accountants,
yeah,
which so also maybe deprive our general population's assets because they take away their home even with illegal foreclosure. But in this model, you didn't address any of those.
Yeah, so So thank you for asking that question. So two points I want to make there. First point is that, we would have loved to address, as Ted alluded to, there are lots of pieces that are moving here. We would have loved to have addressed all those pieces. The problem that we found when we – this is kind of one of the lessons from the paper – when we set out to analyze it was there just wasn't good data to get into complexities like you're talking about. But the other thing I want to say is that you should look at the policy brief that is a companion piece to this paper, because we do talk there about kind of lessons from the credit. And one thing that we do highlight, and it's highlighted in the paper too, is that there are important distributional effects of these programs. And that was just outside the scope of our paper. But there are lots of different kind of winners and losers. What we were trying to look at was the effects, broadly speaking, on the macroeconomy. Yes.
Thank you. Jennifer Lee, I'm with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. I wonder if you can provide some overall assessment on the housing market. So how the demand and the supply are evolving now. Is it strong enough to support the economic recovery? And also we see the housing price is increasing now. Do you think it's still on a reasonable level and is it affordable? And also last question is about the Federal Reserve might taper the asset purchase later this year. Do you think it will have any impact on the housing, perhaps confidence or anything related?
So you're setting us up nicely for the panel. So I hope all the panelists were taking notes because you've got four prominent experts on these issues that are just about to get on stage and speak. So I'm going to defer it to them. But it would be great if you guys could touch on some of these issues. Yeah, Ted's giving me yes. We are. We want to stay on schedule, so we're going to call the panel up now. But thank you very much.
Panel up yet. I'm Bill Gale. I'm going to moderate the discussion. As Karen mentioned, there are a whole variety of issues in addition to the ones that Karen and Ted raised in their paper, and the point of our panel is to get into those issues. We have an excellent panel for you representing a wide variety of vantage points, perspectives on the real estate industry, and as the questions just indicated, the issues are broad and varied here. The distributional effects, you can think of housing as the ultimate life cycle consumption good. There's the role of credit markets. There's the role of housing in the macroeconomy. So we've got, four panelists will each make individual presentations. We'll start with Chris Mayer, from the Columbia Business School, who's going to, come up to the podium and make a presentation. And then after he's done, we'll have presentations from Jed Kolko at Trulia, Jonathan Hanks at the Utah Housing Corporation, Ed Parady at Parady Homes, who will be up here and mic'd and we'll be talking, and then we'll open the floor up for discussion and questions. So let me turn it over to Chris, and looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Okay, so we are in a bit of backward-looking, a bit forward-looking. I'll give one anecdote to sort of start my comments. I thought it was a really, really interesting paper. I was giving a talk up at Harvard in November of 2009, and they have a group that meets twice a year of sort of major housing participants. And they're literally, this was the day that this was being debated, I think it was in the Senate, as to whether there was going to be a renewal of the housing tax credit. And there was literally somebody who was on the phone with their lobbyist. And these are sort of major home builders and other sort of folks who are literally update the group on an hourly basis as to what the negotiations were and whether this was going to pass the Senate or not. So I should say that people in the industry at the time thought this was a really, really big deal. And they were incredibly interested in its passage. And I think you can see in the results this idea that one of the things these programs did was generate sales, which I think people sort of perceived as really just kind of some good news in the process. I think there were lots of places where this came up. So it's not just looking at this renewal. There were lots of, the Federal Reserve was consistently doing things. The administration were sort of making various changes. So I think, I appreciated both the careful analysis in the paper, the exhaustive analysis of all the different programs. And I think the idea that it's kind of hard to isolate any one of these things together, but, the overall set of policies certainly played a role in kind of stabilizing the market. I think that point, I agree with. I always have sort of felt, and you'll see in my comments now, that we didn't do enough to help. And this wouldn't have been – extending this program further wouldn't have been on my list of things to do a lot more of. But I do think that there was more that we could have done at the time. I'll also sort of point out that if you just sort of look at the overall, this is just kind of vacant housing. One of the things that's kind of gotten us out of this mess really has been, you could sort of see that this is the decline in vacant units. These are rental, this is ownership. And these are vacancy rates. You know, they're the bulk of homes in the United States are actually 2/3 are in the ownership camp. And so this resulted in, this is millions of homes that were completely unoccupied. And the idea at the time of bringing first-time buyers in or anybody in was to try and, have people occupy some of those vacant homes. One of the reasons I think we don't turn out to look like Japan is a simple observation, which is, which many people in 2010 were talking about in 2009 and 2008 was simply population growth. The United States is adding population when the household rate, household growth rate was, may have been smaller than it had been, but nonetheless, you know, we were still adding 500,000, 600,000, 800,000 households a year over that period and over a period of time. That kind of filled up the housing. And your sort of theory about how kind of a tax credit can help this, in essence, it may have accelerated a little bit what was going on, but basically what we needed to do to stabilize prices was to fill up vacant houses, which, along with the foreclosure process, were causing things to spin down. And to that extent, if we were able to bring in, you know, some more people, that may have helped things a bit. I'm going to talk for just a second about a couple of the other things we did at the time. And those, I'm going to really focus on the mortgage market in particular. And, you know, to some extent, policy has always been a problem. The issues with policy have been part a problem of sort of overestimating what effects were. So, for example, the idea of trying to prevent foreclosures, which were ending up with distressed sales, which were pushing down prices, the idea is, well, we're going to help sort of modify mortgages. And the administration came out with the HAMP program very soon after President Obama was elected. I think it was March of 2009. That program said we're going to put 3 to 4 million people, we're going to save 3 to 4 million foreclosures with modifications, and we're going to help refinance another 3 to 5 million households. The actual numbers came nowhere close to what the administration was targeting. Interestingly, just before they came out with the HAMP program in the winter before, in December and January, with a couple other co-authors, we actually did some estimates of what we thought mortgage modification could be, and our published numbers that slightly predated this program were something on the order of eventually 1.5 million foreclosures saved, which I think is going to end up being about where we end up with the HAMP program at the end of the day. Tomek Piskorski and Sumit Agarwal and others have done some estimate that suggested actually the bulk of those modifications really did work to reduce foreclosures. That is, those people who did get modifications, a substantial number of them were people who eventually didn't end up being foreclosed. But that said, the program itself was just incredibly bureaucratic, a large amount of paperwork, very structured process. And what we had suggested even at the end of 08 was you should have a very simple rule. It is in lenders' and homeowners' interests for them to continue paying their loan because foreclosure is expensive. So instead of prescribing a rigorous process, maybe we should have a very simple rule. You take someone who's delinquent, if you can get them back to current, we'll give you some bonus as a servicer and not have taxpayers try and follow this complicated rule. At the end of the day, many, many private lenders opted out of HAMP because of the bureaucracy and the structured nature of the program. And I think had we done something very simple, and this is one of the advantages of the tax credit program, it was a very simple program. You qualified, you didn't. Everybody sort of knew how to implement it, and the take-up was pretty big, whereas the take-up of HAMP was much more complicated and ended up not being as successful in terms of the number of people who ended up in the program. We've also discovered, by the way, that the whole issue of moral hazard is much less than people thought. Homeowners really, really do like living in their home. The vast majority of them don't just walk away if they're there's some strategic value or something goes wrong. And I think one of our enduring lessons of the crisis is moral hazard is something economists pay a lot of attention to. There were some homeowners that did it, but the bulk of homeowners, and I think studies have looked at this, really, you know, view being forced out of their home and moving their families as very costly. And it was something that they, for the most part, weren't doing, other than investors who, of course, walked away, you know, as soon as anything went bad. The other thing we did, which obviously was Fannie, Freddie, and the FHA, you know, this is something that clearly of all the things that were done had the biggest effect in this. And I would have sort of said that it was not necessarily just the government backing of the program. It was actually the Federal Reserve purchases of securities that were really what stabilized the market. And the easiest way to see that is that in the fourth quarter of 2008, the federal government put full faith in essentially stepped in to say they would guarantee the obligations of Fannie and Freddie. And what happened? Spreads on Fannie and Freddie securities actually kept going up, and credit was even more difficult. The big turning point, if you want one turning point to the housing market, was when the Federal Reserve announced that they were going to start buying mortgage-backed securities. You saw immediately in when that announcement took place, literally to the day, spreads on those securities went from 300 over down and dropped 150 basis points almost immediately. And you can still see in the movements today that the Federal Reserve, of all the parties involved in housing, by far played the dominant role in terms of what was happening. Their willingness to step in and back those securities, whatever your view of whether it was right or wrong, had the Federal Reserve not acted, all of the rest of this would have been rounding error, and the mortgage market really was on the verge of collapsing, absent the Fed's, you know, large-scale purchases in the mortgage market. The thing is, the Federal Reserve didn't control the people setting credit standards, and much to the Fed's chagrin, what happened was Fannie and Freddie, and to a lesser extent the FHA, started tightening credit. And so you could sort of see, I just brought a couple of pictures and I'll finish up. This is what happened to the private market. It completely disappeared. It went to zero, more or less, off of what were, you know, annual issuances of the $600 to $800 billion a year range. That the economy even survived, that's pretty stunning, but it gives you a sense of how important the credit markets were in this. This, by the way, is just what's happened to loans. Lest we think the housing market is doing great, one of the things to look at is the number of first mortgages has gone from 55 million to 48.5 million. A lot of the pickup has been people buying with cash and without credit. You can either look at that as good or bad. You know, there are lots of articles about Canadians, Chinese buyers, others coming in buying homes, but a lot of investors kind of stepped in with cash purchases in a way which has helped stabilize the market. But credit, the amount of number of loans, number of houses purchased with credit has continued to diminish. This is the home purchase index put out by the Mortgage Bankers Association. And you can see that the sort of uptick in activity and other things was not followed by an uptick in mortgages. So particularly purchase mortgages. So lots of people were losing their homes and people were buying those homes, and some of the attention was coming presumably not from people with the tax credit, but from people who were doing without cash. So these, you can sort of get a sense of what happened. And finally, refinancing activity, which if you know me and some of my stuff has been my huge bailiwick. You know, if you look at 2002 and 2003, even though rates were much less low than they are today, refinancing activity never got anywhere near that. And it's really because the only people who were able to refinance or get credit were people with very, very high FICO scores. So you can look at the, you know, by quarter, the average GSE FICO scores are on the order of 760 to 770. That's unprecedented. You can go back, you know, a very, very long time and not see those kind of FICO scores. The people that have those FICO scores had to get through the recession unscathed. And for all the conversation of bad behavior and moral hazard, et cetera, you know, the bulk of people in trouble in the recession were people who lost their jobs and have not been able to find jobs regularly. And those folks have really been locked out of, even if their income is reduced, of the housing market. And you can see the FHA, the same category now, average FHA loans are over 700. This is not what happened to other forms of credit. You can see this is a pickup in bank credit. This is a pickup in bank auto loans, auto finance. All these other forms of credit actually came up significantly coming out of the crisis. This is in part why we've started to see consumers spending again. It really, well, it's unique to housing that the credit didn't come back in the same way. And it's really been 90%+ of that credit has been run by government institutions. This is, by the way, subprime credit cards, not where they were before. But if you have a FICO of less than 660, you can get a subprime credit card today. You can also get a subprime auto loan today. What you can't get is a mortgage. And I don't know what the right cutoff is. Certainly, it's probably not the 580 folks who were buying with little money down before the crisis, but somehow it isn't also setting home ownership at 700 plus FICOs with everything else and large down payments in place. So we're going to have to find a middle ground here. Hopefully, private capital is going to be part of the way, but I do think policy is going to play an enormously important role for a long time going forward. And this is just my point about household formation as well, which is there's a big gap here, and you could tell a pretty compelling story which says we're going to have a lot of upside in housing as some of those households start to get back in place, although again, the labor market headwinds, many people who have just dropped out of the labor force are playing a role in whether household formation gets back to its trend. But there's a pretty big gap here, and that gap could easily lead to millions of homes being built if we start seeing the labor market recover. And that could, you know, there really is upside to me, significant upside, on the housing market going forward. So I think policy hasn't done as much as it could have. I think one of the lessons from this crisis that we ought to take, which is, by the way, a common lesson across many, many different varieties of credit crunches that we've seen going back a very long time, is it's really important to try and restore normal types of credit. What that means is, as we bring private capital in, we have to continue to focus on countercyclical credit policies that have the government kind of coming in and out to help support the market when it's really needed, but also setting standards on the private side that are really important. About $8 trillion of housing wealth was destroyed in the crisis. That's about the same, as Chairman Bernanke's pointed out, as the amount of wealth that was destroyed by the internet sector. The problem was the internet sector didn't take out the banking system. The housing crisis did take out the banking system. And by taking out the banking system, it killed the provision of new credit. That sort of took us down. That's sort of this very old view about how credit crunches work and the supply of new credit relative to old credit. And to my mind, that's really kind of one of the enduring lessons we have, and hopefully something that policymakers are going to work to stabilize. So.
First of all, I'd like to thank Karen and Ted both for doing this work and for inviting us here. I wanted to start out with a couple of comments about the tax credits in particular and the paper, then a couple broader thoughts about why good housing policy in the U.S. Has been so difficult, and then finally some thoughts about the housing market generally, what it is. Lots of people are worrying about that I'm not especially worried about, and then the few things that I actually am pretty worried about as the housing recovery continues. I think, though, first starting with the paper and the credits, I think the paper did a very good job at looking at a range of outcomes. When we think about the relationship between housing and the macroeconomy, it is never just about sales or just about home starts or just about prices. It's about a range of things. And there are policies both at the federal and state level, and I think the paper does a very good job of looking broadly at all of those questions to get at it. You're very clear that the focus was on macro outcomes, but I want to say a couple of words about possible micro or distributional effects of these policies that most charitably would be ironic, less charitably could be alarming. These are things that would be very hard to measure, you know, what the effects actually were. But just looking at the design of these credits, there are two things that, again, were at least ironic. The first is thinking about the mechanism of essentially subsidizing upfront costs for buying homes. That's what these credits were. First-time home buyers, income cap. So first-time home buyers, lower to middle income, subsidizing upfront costs, though not continuing costs. So basically making it easier to buy the home upfront, though not helping making it easier to pay the mortgage. Now, you know, if you were to ask what else happened in the past 10 years that sounds like that, that sounds a lot like the kinds of toxic mortgages that we saw a lot of during the bubble. In a sense, you know, subsidizing upfront costs, though not recurring costs, for first-time homebuyers who we know are less financially savvy, which we know from recent research makes a difference. You know, you could argue this is another form of teaser rate. This is a way of getting people into homes who might or might not be able to afford those homes going forward, especially at what turned out to be not at the tail end of a hard economic time. Now, of course, we don't know. It would be very hard to measure at the individual level what happened to people who took advantage of these credits. But you know, that's the first irony of the micro-distributional aspect of these credits. The second goes to some of the state policies. There were a couple of states where the credit was focused specifically on newly built homes, so not just or necessarily first-time home buyers, but buyers of newly built homes. I live in California. I was at a PPIC, a state and local think tank in California, at the time. And, you know, this was a time when these 2 years were basically the only time in the past 20 years when a housing shortage was not California's main housing problem. Yet, the distributional impact of a credit that focuses on newly built homes would be a policy that would, you know, the intent would be to stimulate construction. Essentially, at the one moment when that was not California's problem, it is the rest of the time. Thinking about rules and reforms to make it easier to build housing in California is probably the most important housing issue that the state faces, except not at the moment when there was this credit to encourage the building of housing. The other point is, given that part of the crisis was about people being underwater and people who would otherwise be selling their homes not doing so, a credit that essentially subsidized purchases of new homes implicitly made those who wanted to sell existing homes less in a position to do so if they're competing with new homes on which there's a credit. So there could have been some impact where people who were underwater saw their home values drop more or rise less than in the absence of that credit. So I think when we think about the micro impacts based on the design of some of these credits, there are additional reasons, again, either if you think of this as ironic, to be amused, or worse, to be concerned. I think it gets to the bigger question about why housing policy in the U.S. Has been such a challenge. And I agree with Chris that we ended up doing a lot less than we could have and often focused on things that weren't the most pressing issue over the past 5 years. I think there are four sort of political economy reasons why good housing policy in the U.S. is so difficult. I think the first is that too often the answer, the starting point in the answer is we need more home ownership. Given what has happened the past 2 years, I think lots of people have been disabused of that notion. It is now safer to say that, you know, the optimal level of home ownership is something possibly lower than it is at the moment, as opposed to always higher. But I think it makes it too easy to pass and too hard to object to policies where part of the effect might be an increase in home ownership, like such credits. I think the second reason why U.S. housing policy, especially in the past few years, has been so difficult is concerns about moral hazard. Now, I completely agree with Chris that moral hazard turned out to be overstated, but as a barrier to formulating policy, moral hazard turned out to be the lightning rod. I mean, think back to the debate over principal reduction a year and a half ago. You know, basically, one side thought the other was ignorant of moral hazard. That side thought the other was obsessed with moral hazard. And consumers, in response to surveys, lined up very clearly about their willingness or refusal to accept the fact that some people who might not be deserving could benefit from housing policies. There is no way to look into someone's heart to know whether they got into a home that they couldn't afford due to something that was their own fault or not. But the political divide over how much moral hazard to accept, especially in the absence of really understanding how much of a problem this was, got in the way of policies that required some view on how much is tolerable. I think the third is that there's a bit of an institutional mess that underlies what housing policy we would do. Almost any policy, of course, is going to be incremental on existing institutions. And something like a tax credit is fairly easy institutionally because adding something to the tax code is, relatively speaking, simple. When we compare it, at least, to HAMP and HARP and the Robeson and settlement and everything else, where you had this patchwork of policies. And as a consumer, if you were trying to figure out which credit you were entitled to or which policy you qualified for, you had to know who was your servicer, who guaranteed your loan. So it was such that there was this patchwork that developed that not only was complicated for consumers, but violated basic rules of horizontal equity, where people in essentially similar situations, save for the fact that one person's loan might be guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie, the other's not, or one is serviced by a particular servicer and the other's not, would be eligible for very different kinds of programs. And if we're building policy over an overlay of that kind of institutional framework, is going to be inequitable. People will be confused, and people will fall through the cracks. That's a third sort of challenge policy. The fourth is that so much of the action is actually not at the federal level. So much of what are the most important housing policies in the U.S. Are local or at least localized. Building regulations set the local level, probably as important as almost anything else when it comes to affordability. In the foreclosure crisis, we know that state foreclosure laws had a huge impact, not only on the speed of foreclosure, but also on the impact on prices state by state. Even federal policies that apply to the U.S. overall have sometimes inappropriately differential effects in different parts of the country. Of course, some things like the conforming loan limit do vary across space. But think back to, I think it was about 9 months ago when FHFA proposed adjusting the guarantee fees, raising them in five states where Fannie and Freddie's carrying costs were higher because of the slower foreclosure process. This was a case of wanting to essentially price risk to reflect geographic differences in risk. That ended up being a big political firestorm. I think the fourth challenge for U.S. policy is trying to, both in the recovery and beyond, overcome fragmented local markets, fragmented institutions, political partisan differences around moral hazard, and the overwhelming presumption about more homeownership. So that's two out of three things I wanted to do. First, a couple cynical, that was the cynical section, by the way, on a bit of a micro take on policies and then U.S. policy overall. The more optimistic take is where the housing market is right now, what I'm not so worried about, what I do worry about. There are a lot of things that I'm not as worried about as lots of other people are, as we are in the housing recovery and moving somewhat more back to normal. Mortgage rates are rising. They're still incredibly low by historic norms. When we look at what the cost of buying versus renting is, both for consumers and for investors, we have a long way to go. Rates could rise much, much more before that actually changes, such that renting becomes more expensive than buying. As I'm going to say in a minute, and I totally agree with Chris, I think the availability of credit is a much bigger concern than rising rates. More on that in a sec. The second, are we seeing a new housing bubble? Yes, prices are rising. Not yes, we're seeing a housing bubble. It is the case that prices are rising as fast as they were right now, as they were during the bubble. But when we compare prices to incomes and rents over the longer term, nationally, prices still look 7% undervalued compared with fundamentals, compared with the longer term. Of course, if prices rise at the rate they're going right now, for the next several years, we'll be back in bubble territory. That's very unlikely that prices will rise at this current pace. So I think bubble fears are overblown, especially given the rising rates. system. The third thing that I'm less worried about than others is the role of investors in this housing recovery. There's been a lot of press recently about investors swooping in with lots of cash, outbidding buyers, bidding up prices, tight inventory, being slumlords once they rent them out, lots of concerns. All these things may have some truth to them. But I think the bigger question thinking about investors' role is what's the counterfactual? What would have happened in the housing recovery if it weren't for the role of investors? Remember, the one policy that everyone pretty much got behind was the REO to rental program a year or two ago. That's essentially what investors have been doing. And without investors buying up homes and renting them out, we would have today a lot more vacant homes and a lot more people without homes than we do right now. So I think some of the concerns about investors' role in the recovery have been overblown, and I think the recovery is a lot better off than it would be without their actions. So then what it is, and just to wrap up, what are the three things that I actually do worry about? The first is what happens to mortgage credit. Again, echoing Chris, mortgage credit looks on many measures still to be very tight. There have been some new indicators suggesting it's loosening a bit, but still very difficult for people to get mortgages. Uncertainty with QM coming into effect next year about what impact that will have. It's also unclear whether rising rates will diminish refinancing demand enough that banks instead end up looking more to make home purchase loans. Still to be seen, but that's the first thing that is worth worrying about. The second is young people. 25 to 34-year-olds had a much worse recession than other adults. They've taken on more student debt. That makes them less able to save for down payment, less able to qualify for a mortgage. They're particularly important for household formation, even though more have moved out of their parents' homes, probably to everyone's delight. It's still far from normal. And what happens to them, I think, is critical for the housing recovery. And then finally, affordability. Took a back seat, of course. When prices were falling, it's very hard to get upset about high prices. It's a problem that never really went away, particularly in expensive coastal cities. Much of this is beyond our control, of course. If God didn't want San Francisco to be expensive, she wouldn't have put an ocean on one side, a bay on the other, and mountains a few miles further. So much of the cost of housing in coastal markets has to do with geography and topography. But regulations make it worse. Lots of us hope that gets back to the top of the agenda when we talk about affordability, of how to make it easier to build in places where we know demand is perennially strong. So I'll end with those worries. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So we moved from California dreaming to the hot, dry state of Utah. And Jonathan will tell us about what's going on there.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And it is hot and dry in Utah. And yesterday, I've never heard this announcement on the airplane, but they were telling everybody that we were going to be overweight because it was so hot. And I've heard that in Phoenix before, in Las Vegas, but not in Salt Lake. So to come here, it was actually the temperature was nice, but I really don't like the humidity. I thought about walking here from the hotel, and I hit the lobby and changed my mind very quickly. So I'd like to give you just a little background. First, just a question. How many of you have ever been to Utah? Oh, that's pretty good.
About years.
It's a great time to go. And I'm glad you come and visit and that you come back to wherever you live from so that we don't have to have all the congestion that you have back here. Utah Housing is a quasi-state government. We're a public corporation of the state. And there is a state housing agency in every state in the country. And we don't receive any state tax dollars. Were completely self-funded, which is different than a lot of the other states. There were several states that came up with programs to go along with the federal home buyer credit. Utah Housing worked with the governor's office to come up with one program is called the Home Run Program. We did two iterations of it. And the governor's office said, look, we have some money coming from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And so the governor's office actually asked the president of Utah Housing to put together a housing advisory council that was composed of realtors, lenders, brokers, government entities, to try and figure out what would be the best way to utilize some of this stimulus money to get the biggest bang for the buck in Utah. And so this housing advisory council came back with a recommendation that a grant be given to people to incentivize them to purchase homes. Now, Utah is a little bit behind the times in terms of when we go into an economic malaise and come out of it. Typically, our housing market really started to tank in 2008, the beginning of 2008. Things were fairly robust up through the fourth quarter of 2007. But our housing inventory, a healthy inventory of homes on the market, and this is pretty much in the Wasatch Front area, which is about an 80-mile by 15-mile stretch north and south of Salt Lake City, which is about where 75% of the population of Utah resides. But in that area, a healthy market is 1,000 to 1,200 units on the market. In the beginning of 2006, there were about 580 units available. I'm sorry, it was 850, a little dyslexia there. And but 3 years later, in the beginning of 2009, there were 3,000 units of brand new construction that were sitting on the market. And so the Housing Advisory Council said, look, I think one of the things that we need to do is to reduce the inventory. And so the first home run grant was $6,000. It was limited to income, $75,000 for an individual, $150,000 for a married couple, and targeting affordable housing, which in Utah meant less than $300,000. It's actually come down since then. But in the first that first iteration, we had $10 million allocated to Utah Housing to run the program. The funds were not Utah Housing's, they were the state's, so we ran it for the state. A little more than 1,600 units of brand new inventory. These were brand new construction, never been lived in homes, had been cleared from inventory within 3 months. That $10 million and $6,000 increments was reserved and given to home buyers, 64% of whom were first-time home buyers. It was cleared in 12 weeks. And as you notice on the sheet I gave you, I'm not going to go through a whole lot of detail there, but it did, the homes sold during that time or in that program were worth about $376 million, which is a big boon to Utah. The second item, I guess, when we went to Home Run 2, we went through that money so quickly that the Housing Advisory Council was reconvened and said, what else can we do? The biggest sector, or the sector that took the biggest losses in employment in Utah was the residential construction sector. There was a lot of commercial building going on, but the residential sector took a 21% hit in employment, a reduction in employment from 2008 to 2009, and it went down again by another 10% or so from 2009 to 2010. The second prong, or the second part of the program, Home Run 2, was to encourage building. There was a lot of overhead or the excess inventory that was eliminated through Home Run 1. The builders and all the other people in this Housing Advisory Council determined that we need to get jobs back. And part of that getting jobs back first was to eliminate the excess. And then with the second round, we did a $4,000 grant. And with the $4,000 grant, that was for repeat home buyers. And there was a lot of encouragement to use that money to go with or to enter into a contract to build a new home. And it looked, what came out of it is that about 50% of the $4,000 grants that were given, and there were about $2,000 grants given, about half of those went to new construction. And so one of the goals of the program was to stabilize, first was to get rid of excess inventory and stabilize housing prices, which it clearly did. Housing prices were dropping in 2009, and I look at Utah Housing's portfolio. Our portfolio, our average loan balance had dropped from $154,000 to $142,000 during a year-and-a-half time period when these 1,500 or 1,600 homes were sold under Home Run. That stabilized. We didn't go any lower than $145,000, and the average has been going back up. One of the challenges with these kinds of studies is trying to figure out, well, did which one really had a great effect? And we did a survey of all of the Home Run grant recipients and asked, what made the biggest difference in you deciding to purchase your home right now? In Home Run 1, the most important thing then was interest rates. The interest rates had come down. But the second most important item was this $6,000 grant. They could use the $6,000 grant and the $8,000 tax credit, and they were able to have a substantial either down payment or some equity going to the home immediately. Secondly, the other thing was to try and provide construction jobs, or at least to stabilize that. There's an economist at the University of Utah who did a study trying to determine, well, how many jobs were saved or how many were added. He came back and said, I can't tell you. It's impossible to tell. He said, well, there were 19,000 jobs created in building the homes, the 3,600 homes, but those were obviously not all created by this program. So as we look back at it, and as we've heard anecdotal information from the builders and the lenders across our state, they clearly have said that it made a huge difference in their lending ability and getting this excess inventory off the books so they could stabilize the prices and get more folks into homes. Now, one of the concerns raised was, are we going to borrow future homeowners? Well, for those of you who don't know, Utah has the highest birth rate in the nation and also is the youngest state in the nation. Home formation is very high, and there had been pent-up demand in the state, and so 2009 rolled around. There, people hadn't been buying for a good year and a half to 2 years. Home formation is continuing to rise, and we have not seen any blowback, if you will, that future home sales, as we look back now in 2013, home sales were not affected at all negatively by introducing this program. And right now, the market in Utah is actually doing very well. There's simply not enough inventory and multiple offers on properties. And so we feel from a policy perspective, although Utah is a very red state, we took the federal money that came and used it in a very effective way that we think has really helped the Utah economy. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ed.
All right, thank you. So we've heard a lot about people who think about housing policy or design housing policies and talk with someone that actually knows what it's like to build a house.
Out on the streets,
and,
right.
Yeah, so Ed, please.
Well, thanks. I want to commend the work, obviously, of the paper, and I think that the paper is important for the ages because I'm in the home building industry and the real estate industry. We know it's a cyclical business, and that cycle will come back to where we have to look at these types of tax credits. And so I think the paper is well done, and the analysis that the paper presents is very similar to what I think our industry has kind of drawn from the are concluded from the tax credits. But I think it's first important to go back to 2008 and find out, you know, where we came from in my industry. Our industry actually started seeing declines in late 2005, 2006. So between 2005 and 2006, new starts had dropped 53%. By January of 2008, they had dropped almost 63%. So there was a lot of pain within our industry. A lot of small businesses, a lot of employers went out of business. Our average member at the National Association of Home Builders, a builder throughout the country, has less than 10 employees and builds less than 10 homes. So it's a very decentralized business. The production builders, the public companies do take 25-30% of the marketplace, but in general, you're talking about Main Street family businesses that were devastated during this crisis. And so by the time 2008 came, when they introduced HERA, we were certainly looking for some help to revitalize the industry, to help take care of some of the inventory overhang that was on the market. And so we supported these types of tax credits. HERA really was pre-stimulus, and it was a loan, so we don't feel that it was very effective, and I think the statistics prove that out. The second phase, where it was actually a grant tax credit, not refundable tax credit, that you didn't have to pay it back, certainly had an impact on reducing inventories and starting to increase market share. Part of our problem, as we've suggested on this panel all day, is availability of credit, not only to the home buyer, but to the builder and the developer. Acquisition, development, construction credit tightened very, very much. And so even though we were able to get rid of some of our inventory, we weren't able to create. It didn't have the effect of creating as many new construction sites as some had hoped through the stimulus. One, the buyers were down. Credit was very tight there, and still remains fairly tight for our buyers. And so although we may build over, you know, come close to 1 million units this year in 2013, we dropped significantly to 300,000-400,000 units. And so there was a lot of pain in the industry. So we felt that the $7,500 tax credit, the second generation, was effective. The third generation, offering to not only new home buyers but existing home buyers, was probably effective getting rid of some inventory. But as the study suggests, it's a $23 billion tax expenditure. 3.3 million people or million households took advantage of it. And so the question, what do you gain from it? And what were the benefits? Well, it certainly stemmed the price declines, which was a huge problem for foreclosures, people underwater. So if it had a major effect, in my opinion, the most effective part of the tax credits were stemming that decline. Without it, we would have seen, in my opinion, would have seen continued declines in price. And so more and more households would have been underwater, more and more foreclosures. Foreclosures is a whole different issue as far as state by state and where the challenges are on foreclosures and how long it takes. But the tax credit certainly stemmed the decline in prices. So that was a huge, huge benefit. It did increase job creation through new home construction. If you look at the statistics, the existing home sales spiked greatly and declined greatly after. So the payback was much stronger in existing home sales than it was in new construction. We did have an increase in new home sales, and we had less payback in new construction as well. So it wasn't as effective on the new construction side. Personally, in my business, we did buy business from the future, so we did see a huge uptick when the tax credits took part. And then we did have a, what I call a very black and dusty time immediately after, from my perspective, in a home building business. But generically, nationwide, you didn't see that huge payback in new construction. So it probably increased nationwide new home construction maybe 10%, but again, did not see that huge decline. So the benefits, did the benefits of this, these generation, three generations of tax credits make the industry happy? The new home industry? No. I would say that it didn't, as Chris suggested, we were all looking for something to jump on to try and stimulate the housing market, and I don't think it generated what we were hopeful of. Part of that the problem was there were three generations. It was a very complicated process, and it was we were out there trying to educate people on how you could take advantage of the tax credit and which tax credit. So I think the way that it was presented and the continuation and the growth and extensions were somewhat problematic making it as effective as it could have been. I think it's also noted in the study, and I support, that the actual cost, the revenue loss to the federal government is somewhat misleading when you look at a $23 billion price tag, because the indirect impact that the study suggests of people, new household formations and people entering home ownership, on average spend $7,000 to $8,000 over the next 2 years within the economy, buying brooms and buying garbage cans and buying lawnmowers and so forth. So there was a stimulus impact indirectly generated from the tax credit as well. How do you make in our opinion, how do you make the tax credit better if you do get into another cycle that you look at it? I think it would have been more effective if it was one package. If it was a tax credit that over time potentially would have gradually declined, so introduce a tax credit at an 8,000 level, let it take it over 2 years or 3 years or 1 year, whatever the time frame is, a date certain, or potentially even open-ended to look at when the market corrects itself, because a short term certainly gives that payback opportunity, and so if you graduate a tax credit maybe over time, it would be better. Monetization, we talked about in 2008, a direct monetization of that tax credit would have been a huge benefit and probably helped stimulate. There is debate on whether or not that's, you know, low down payment, whether they're defaults, but under the current underwriting standards, I serve on the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago Board of Directors. We have an AHP program, affordable housing program, that if underwritten correctly with a down payment assistance program, underwritten correctly, our default rates are very low. So if you combine tax credits or lower down payments with correct underwriting, they can be effective. The cash for clunkers was an example, I think, of how you monetize that immediately. You go buy a car, you get a $1,000 check, and so you got to look at some type of monetization. And the housing finance agency certainly tried to do that throughout the country with low or zero down payment or low zero interest loans to bridge those gaps. But you know, overall, specifically to the tax credit, some have asked, would you support it again? What we really need in this country, and most recently I've served on the Bipartisan Policy Center's Housing Commission, what we really need in this country is a stable housing finance system. And before we talk about tax credits and potentially mortgage interest deduction and tax expenditures by the federal government, we really need, and what we did at the Bipartisan Center is try and create a energy to that dialogue of GSE reform, what happens to Fannie and Freddie, and if we have a impact in this country today, it will be to create a stable, sustainable housing finance system with certainly private private equity into the market. But in my opinion, again, certainly need the government to play in that market as well. So having said that, keeping in mind that you create a job, three jobs out of every new construction home, we need a strong, vibrant housing market, a new construction market in this country. So I'll stop with that.
All right, thank you. Very interesting. We've gotten a lot of perspectives on the housing market, how it affects the economy, and vice versa. Before I say anything else, I just want to ask, do any of the panelists want to respond to anything or elaborate on anything that any of the other panelists said? Is there anything that piqued?
Yeah. I'll just make one sort of observation, which is I do think that as we have conversations, one of the big conversations we still sort of, I think, need to have in a much more substantive way is just understanding how to think about home ownership and, you know, what are the justifications or not justifications for it. And I would sort of make a very, you know, I'll throw out a couple of provocative comments when I have time to kind of go into them. Basically, I do think home ownership is very important. It's particularly important for wealth creation and savings. And we just kind of have to ask the question, which is, what happens if people hit retirement as renters? What do they look like? And unless we're really good at developing other kinds of savings programs, I do think home ownership in a broader context is important. None of that says that we're supposed to deal with this through mortgage interest deduction or other things. And if you look across other countries, the U.S. home ownership rate is not particularly high relative to other industrialized countries across various kinds of things. So I do think that there's a larger conversation to be had about what the government's role in that is, how to make that more stable. That occurs both through, you know, how we finance it and also, you know, what role we play. And I do think that's important, which means if I'm going to go that direction, I'm not a huge fan longer term of kind of the push of investors. And I'll say I've done some research on the role of investors in housing markets, and the problem is they do actually have a causal effect in pushing prices up. That's really good when prices are low. The question is, how do we transition back out of that, or do we, when prices start rising more rapidly, given the role of psychology and other kinds of things that people have? And most of the investors are not the Blackstones and Colony Capitals of the world. They're local investors who are buying 1, 2, 5, you know, homes, et cetera. So toss out.
I think when it comes to policies and evaluating credit specifically, it's always important to ask, you know, what are the alternative policies or alternative approaches that could have met those same goals? There are of course trade-offs in terms of financial resources and trade-offs in terms of political attention, political capital. In the conversation today, there were lots of different types of goals that the tax credit might have met, stimulating the economy overall, raising home ownership, raising employment and activity in the building industry, raising employment and activity in the other parts of the real estate industry. But I think the important question is, you know, what was, since we can't do everything, what was the most important goal at the time, and what would be the policy or type of policy that would get at that most directly? If the most important goal at the time was to put the construction industry back to work, maybe the right question is tax credits like this versus more spending on public works, given that borrowing costs were so low at the time. Again, if it's stimulating the economy, tax credits, or a much more aggressive and earlier refinancing push that would have put money more quickly in the hands of homeowners to spend on other things. So I think there's always, and that there are always limits to evaluating a policy in isolation, when there's always a menu of policies and a range of different goals.
Great. The one thing that I saw that came out of all this was, besides what people have mentioned, is that the localness, if you will, of real estate and housing issues. Now, we talk about this as a national issue, and it has national implications, but you know, the situation in Utah might be rosy because there's lots of young families coming up the chain, and the situation in Detroit might be awful because the auto industry is going down. And so stuff that has nothing to do with real estate per se is driving the real estate issues in various parts of the country. But anyway, let's turn to questions. Alice, do you have a question?
Yes. Alice Rivlin, Brookings.
I wanted to come back to the point that Professor Mayer raised very dramatically with the charts about the decline of credit over time. And everybody, both the analysis and the anecdotes of all over, would tell you that we've gone from ridiculously loose credit standards to ridiculously tight ones. What is the policy mechanism for getting us back to a sensible middle? I don't know what it is.
So the analogy I sometimes use is we have a garden that we're trying to grow, and we have one person standing at the spigot who's opening up the spigot as much as they can. That was the Federal Reserve. And we have another person or a couple of people who are sitting at the side that's supposed to be spraying the garden, and they're holding on to the hose as tightly as they can and squeezing the hose. That's the bit of the problem,
which is
we have different parties who are doing different things, and their goals are very, you know, are not the same. And so trying to rationalize and have a larger conversation, I think the, you know, Corker, Warner, the Bipartisan Policy Commission are all examples of a broader group of people sitting around and trying to think harder about how to do this. But I think as we design that, we have to think about what that next crisis is going to be so that we don't have somebody again opening the spigot while somebody else is squeezing on the hose.
I think part of this is about sort of the right policy balance, and we've been I think we've been scarred by too loose credit and have swung too far in the other direction. So part of the answer is that I think there's a big consumer awareness and financial literacy piece of this also, and I think this that sometimes gets lost in the policy debate, but greater clarity, sort of like nutritional labeling. Of, you know, there are some basic ways in which it's possible to explain what sort of loans a consumer is getting into, and up to this point, we haven't had enough clarity around that.
But the consumers aren't the problem at the moment; it's the lenders.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, I would suggest that it's regulation, regulators, the lack of clear direction. QM, QRM has taken a long time to define, yet to be defined. Private capital will come into the market when there's some clarity to it, and private capital will, help drive down some of that high cost borrowing at 760, 780 FICO scores. And so part of it's time and clarity.
Great. Let's see. We have time for one or two more questions, Max. Ben?
Thanks. Ben Harris, Tax Policy Center. So in talking about the first-time homebuyer's tax credit, one of the claims you hear, one of the criticisms of it, is that it won't get passed on to consumers. It'll get recaptured in other ways. Do you think there's any validity to that claim, and do you have any evidence either way?
Well, I guess I would say from a person that sells homes, when the first-time homebuyer tax credit came into play, because it wasn't monetized immediately, you had to get the credit when you filed your tax return. I'm not sure how it didn't. It did get to the buyer, but it came over time, and so if you would have, we weren't supplying anything, or we weren't raising the price or anything, if that's what you're suggesting, as a market to overcome that $7,500 or $8,000 tax credit. So I certainly think it went to the consumer.
I would just say from Utah Housing's standpoint that we did have a product that monetized the tax credit. And it did go directly to the homeowner. We saw, gave an option for them to pay back that tax credit when they filed their taxes. We found that nearly nobody wanted to pay that money back when they got their tax credit. We monetized a loan, monetized it in a 30-year amortizing loan that was 2 points higher than their first mortgage rate if they got the loan through Utah Housing. And so the benefit did, we saw that it went directly to the homeowner and put them, it didn't necessarily put them in a greater equity position because they took the tax money when they got the refund and spent it in other places. A lot of times, anecdotally, it was spent on furnishing the home, doing landscaping, things of that nature.
Okay. Last question. Let's go with Karen Dynan.
I just want to ask a little more about this monetization issue because it just, it did, as we were trying to do the paper, it appealed to me so much, this idea that you could get more bang for the buck if you allowed people to actually get the credit in advance so they could put it towards a down payment. We struggled to find some empirical evidence that the states that did these bridge loan programs actually saw a greater take-up of the federal credit or some, you know, even when we were looking at effects on activity, we didn't find them. So I just, now, Jonathan, I think maybe you've spoken to this, but I wonder, from your point of view, Ed, I think Illinois had one of these programs. I was wondering whether you felt like it worked. And then my other part two is a question for Jed, which is just that you expressed concerns about, you know, these credits being a little like taking us back to subprime. Do you feel any better? I mean, so the idea of these monetization features is that they you give it to them early, they put it towards a down payment, so it's kind of locked up. For these households, they have, you know, they can't just go out and spend it on anything. Does it make you feel any better if you have the monetization piece of it?
Want to start? Well, I would just say, I think the monetization issue, how to overcome some of the fears of immediately monetizing it is to somehow restrict where that monetization goes. Whether it should, it, in my again, in my opinion, if it is directly monetized, they're furnishing the house, so it's going. It certainly acts as a stimulus to the economy by monetizing it immediately versus 6 months or 8 months later. But there's some worry there because if you're monetizing it now, you got to pay it back, and come June, April, you don't have the money to pay it back. Does that create more problems in stability of the home? I think maybe the monetization would help, but it should be somewhat restricted as to the use.
Last word, John.
I think that I agree that the concern with monetization is the payback, and you know that there is something that the consumer then owes in exchange. I mean, the psychology in for a consumer deciding like, can I afford to buy a home? You know, certainly we saw in the crisis was weighted way too much toward the initial question of do I have enough today and not sort of forward-looking enough for will I be able to stay in this home long enough in the future? I mean, this, you know, empirically, I have no idea how big an effect this could be, but policies that reinforce the emphasis on having the consumer make the calculation of can I afford this upfront? As opposed to taking a longer-term view of, you know, this is, you know, this should be a 5 or 7 or 10 or longer-year financial decision, you know, having that be at least as much of the focus as can I afford this today?
All right, thank you. Let me first start by thanking Karen and Ted for their presentation and the discussion of their paper. Thank you. I want to thank the panelists for a particularly wide-ranging discussion of how complex it is to think about real estate and the economy. And thank you for attending and for your questions.